This is Ken Vellante with Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. And just a few announcements before we begin with our guest, S.A. Lawrence Welsh, who's a First Nations activist based in Oregon. Her Instagram can be found at Lawrence Welsh NW for Northwest. If you need to find her there, she has a lot of great material on Instagram. I wanted to mention Love Yoga, which is a yoga studio practice that I support in the town of Albany, Oregon. It's run and owned by Suzanne Davis. And just wanted to pass along that it's a great resource for yoga practice. There's an app, a Love Yoga app, but you can find an online library of sessions as well as some an online feed at loveyogastudios.com. Loveyogastudios.com. In addition to this episode with S.A. Lawrence Welsh, upcoming episode with Ben Westhoff, author of American Gangsters, West Coast Hip Hop, NWA, Compton's Most Wanted, and a great thorough history of that story. And that episode is actually going to be co-hosted, first time, with Sam Vellante, my nephew, is a communications major down in Arizona. Also have an episode coming up with Nikki Lynette, hip-hop artist, also mental health advocate and activist. Great music. She is in the process of recording a play that she wrote about her struggle with mental illness that we'll have the opportunity to talk about that project. And also her past creativity, a very prolific artist. And we'll also have the Portland band coming soon, Death Parade, formerly known as Laura Palmer's Death Parade. And looking forward to that episode. The podcast is available on Audible now. Podbean is its source host. You can find Something Rather Than Nothing at Apple, Amazon Music, Spotify, and most everywhere you can access your podcasts. I want to thank you for your support of the program, and if you do enjoy it, ask that you share it with your friends who are interested in philosophy, art, and culture. Review the program, and just thank you for your support and anything you can do to, if you enjoyed the content, to share it with people you know. And now, S.A. Lawrence Welsh.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
This is Ken Vellante with the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast, and we have a guest here, S.A. Lawrence Welsh, who I've encountered through her advocacy work on behalf of First Nations and her work in supporting the arts and quite honestly making change and bringing awareness in the world. So it's been really good to interact with S.A., and I'm happy to introduce her to you right now. Tansay, S.A.
Tanshay. I'll introduce myself traditionally here. So Tanshay, S.A., Dishini Kashun, Treaty 6, Dushin, Clackamas, Kalapuya, Chinook, Niwikin, Monfami, Shini Kashu, Lawrence, Anderson, Pe Gardapi. So what I just said is, hi, my name is S.A. Treaty 6 is my home, which is located in present-day Alberta, Canada, and across parts of the provinces. I presently live on Clackamas and Kalpuya and Chinook land, which is known by its colonizer name as Portland, Oregon. And my family names are Lawrence, Anderson, and Gardapi.
Thank you so much.
That was in Machif.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. And Albany, Oregon, where I am, is the lands of the Kalapuya tribe. I wanted to ask you about when you were younger. A lot of our conversation is going to be based on kind of like art activism and along those lines. But could you get into a little bit whether any of those thoughts or were in your head when you were younger about creating or awareness around advocacy? But in general, what were you like when you were younger?
I was super cool. No, I'm kidding. I had tons of friends. No, I didn't. As a kid, I think I was a pretty stereotypical little bush rat kid. I grew up in the mountains just outside of Rocky Mountain House in Alberta, Canada. I was really fortunate to grow up outside of an urban setting and get to have the experiences outdoors and learn things, you know, from my father about culture and protocol and the things that he was able to teach me from what he retained from his youth and knowledge he had, and given his experiences of being a child of the Canadian residential school system. I was always asking questions, and I was always interested in knowing why things were the way they were, especially growing up a Native, and also being told to hide my identity as a form of self-preservation. I definitely was a very artistic child. It just came as second nature to me. I was always making something. I was always inspired to create things. I was an only child, and or at least thought I was an only child until I was 17 years old when I met my sister, who was actually a child of the 60s scoop era in Canada, where children were forcibly removed or taken from Native parents and placed into adoption facilities to be assimilated and raised white. But so I had a lot of time. It was just my dad and I for a lot of years where I just needed to make outlets because he didn't know how to be a parent and I needed to be amused. But when, as far as it comes to advocacy, you know, I always questioned why things were, again, the way they were. So I can recall my first real interaction with protesting that sort of thing was when I was 15 years old and I was in high school, and I helped orchestrate a student walkout for a teacher who was being let go of. And we definitely believed it was based on color and race issue because they were the only non-white teacher at the school. So I've always had a bit of tenacity in me to fight for right and justice, I guess. Equity.
Yeah. And thank you for that. You know, I work as a union rep in K-12 school system. And I tell you, I've been in situations where I've taken on administration and asked, why do I know all your employees of color? Like, why do I know them all? I shouldn't know them all. And it was just in the sense, even in a large district, that they end up in situations or questions or, you know, curriculum choices are questioned or kids are quote unquote uncomfortable in the class. And it's such a deep problem. But well, thank you for standing up for your teacher there.
Yeah.
One of the things I was interested in, you have a lot of connections and do a lot of work with various groups. And you know, as you know, on the podcast, I get into art as a vehicle or creating art and just its role in culture and in awareness. Could you chat a bit about your relationship in work with groups to promote First Nations or Indigenous art?
Yeah, I, you know, just kind of the more grassroots initiative stuff. You know, I have had a lot of incremental experiences with people regaining access to culturally significant art and that being used as a processes of healing and trauma that they've experienced. And I've also encountered situations where there's just a level of ignorance when it comes to Indigenous art. And I think that, you know, there's really great ways of educating people. You know, I recently made some words on the internet, go figure, about how we can't really hold people accountable for what they were never given. And that includes information. And so I think that, you know, we can offer people information in a kind and in a good way. And then based on their reaction to it, and of course people are, you know, going to become defensive when they're given information that basically peels away and tears down their entire concept of why things are the way they are or whatnot. But one instance I have is my daughter. I've made it a really big point, you know, at her school that she was in from year one to year five, that I would go speak every year, you know, especially around the quote unquote native holidays, because I, even though I'm a guest on these lands, you know, I realize that people don't know how to access people, so I always try and open that door. But I definitely would go in and speak about my culture because, again, too, you know, we deal with this issue of a lot of people being ignorant or thinking that all Native nations are similar. And last year, actually, there was an auction at my daughter's school where classes will create these beautiful little pieces of art, you know, all sizes, shapes, mediums, and auction them off to raise money for the school. And each class has a project. And I was reached out to by my daughter's fourth grade teacher, the teacher she had the year prior, because one of the mothers who was helping lead the art project wanted to do some Indigenous-based art with the children. And so she asked me about the protocol with that. And I said, well, what is she trying to do? She said she wants to do some coastal art. And I was like, well, has she contacted anyone here? You know, the people of these lands. So we got on an email thread and this woman was very much in love with Haida art. And I had a good chuckle because there may be Haida people here, but they're not from here. So why would you want to, you know, create something that doesn't honor the people whose lands you occupy and very much occupy illegally or unethically. And so I brought in a peer of mine who is from the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, which is just outside of Portland. And they are a group of nations that had to come together due to genocide and create a nation unto themselves. And so I brought in a peer who is a teacher as well as an art teacher and has the schooling as such. And so she went through and basically taught the children a lot of really powerful words and tools and gave them an education on where they are. And it's so empowering because it was the parents that were so standoffish to it, but the kids were so receptive. And I think that that's so important as a part of art that, you know, when you're building something, a medium, you're like, you know, children themselves are working, walking pieces of art because they're moldable and you can create them and they can create beauty themselves when they are given the tools that they need, right? So there's things like that where, you know, it's a one instant situation or, you know, whether it be the org that I am so fortunate to sit on the board of, which is the Chapter House, which is currently based in LA, but spans throughout the Navajo Nation. And it's a way of using art to build community and create cathartic, like loving situations to bring people together and ensure that the healing process is elevated through working together and showcasing the beauty that is Indigenous art.
Thank you. I heard in there, and it was really powerful as you described it, the impact on the kids, right? And I think it's worth noting, as you did, that you know, whether it, I don't know, it's the language and the materials, but it sounded like they were being empowered and being able to have the tools and the language in order to express themselves. Do you think it's as simple as that, as I just said it?
I think that, you know, children being given things that don't stunt them, you know, and that I think that's with anything, you know, art aside, you know, that's obviously a part of it. But when you give children the ability to grow and learn and don't stunt them by giving them information that will cloud their judgment or ability to cope with information, you know, because not all information we get and receive is something that's positive, right? So we need to learn how to cope with things. And, you know, watching my peer, who I love just endlessly, you know, teach these kids traditional works that, you know, we're able to teach to non-Native children, you know, and give them these gifts. It's 100% empowering, because they're going to go into situations asking things and knowing maybe their adult counterparts.
Yeah. One of the big questions I ask is what is art? And I was wondering if you could speculate on that.
Well, that's a loaded question, but I think that, you know, obviously speaking from my own perspective, I think art is an expression of a moment that in time that can either transcend or sit still in that period. And it's visual storytelling, it's audible storytelling, because art comes in so many forms, whether it be music, like even literature, mixed mediums. Like, there's so many mediums to create, and that being tied to specific Native nations, you know, like there's woodwork, there's silver work, there's painting, there's etching, there's clay sculpting. Like, there's so many attributes. And, you know, for myself, some of the ways that I interact with art, and the way that what is art to me is, as a Native person, it's something that ties me to my culture. So even though I am, I consider myself a purist of mind, but not always in my actions. And so, you know, beadwork isn't necessarily something that was ours, because it came with trade, right? It came with the trade when settlers and colonizers started coming to these lands. But, you know, quill work, things that we were creating for, like painting on robes, like buffalo calf robes, etc., that we would create as an expression of art, of who we were as peoples. And so to me, art is something that tells a story, whether it be something, again, that transcends this moment or stays still in a moment of time to remind us what we are and where we came from. Because it's one of those things, like food, that and again, another form of art is a food, like that can speak to everyone, no matter what language you actually speak verbally.
I don't have a mic drop audio sound. I don't have an in-person producer. No. Thank you so much. I One of the things I wanted to say, you know, to the audience in having talked and read and read some, you know, the material you produce and some of the organizations you work with, I have particularly enjoyed the challenge to my thought system and, you know, in terms and an analysis that you've used of colonialism and you know, what structures exist in this country and what type of mindsets, what type of language you can use that's permissible to use. On that, we were talking about what is art, but does art have a role, or what is art's role in challenging and or dismantling colonialism?
Well, I don't think that we can decolonize things that were brought here. You know, we can only decolonize the things that were here and that were taken and kind of vulgarized to fit a narrative for the people that came here and wanted to be comfortable, right? I think that creating traditional art and in partaking in traditional practices is how art can work to be a form of or be one of the stepping stones to decolonization, where people can look at something and just accept it because that's the way it's given its integrity, right? Like whatever medium it may be. To see it in its original form is to understand that that's the way things were. Yes, things change, but we can always still understand that there's roots to everything that we're doing. I don't know if that necessarily makes sense, but I think that as art is something to counteract colonialism, the best way to explain that would be just to honor our ancestors and continue doing the things that were taken from us to pass on, so we don't lose our identities.
Yeah, I wonder. I had mentioned to you before, like if you take an art museum, and I have a question for you, kind of like a walkthrough. Since talking to you and thinking about art in whether it's the depiction or let's just say simply the space or the presentation of First Nations Indigenous art. So if we go to the Portland Art Museum, you know, art museums are, you know, traditional in format in general. And there was a Native Fashion Now exhibit. And within the exhibit, as I was going through, I was interested. My mind was open. I was trying to understand what I was seeing, where it came from, who made it, what it means, who wears it, and happened upon the T-shirt. I'm not sure if you've seen it. I think it's like a dark color, and then there's a greenish color, and it's, I don't know, Caucasians rather than, you know, the Indians, the Cleveland Indians, a baseball shirt. And it said Caucasians. So it seemed to be a subversive act. And I've seen people wear that in order to provoke discussions around what's known as Washington's football club now.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I own that shirt.
Do you? Well, I loved it.
Some version of it. And, you know, for me, I can't speak to my relations or my peers or any kin across these lands. But I'll say for me, when I wear it as a statement of agitation and anger, because it's so easy to not feel things when they don't affect you, right? Like, yeah. And that's the thing, you know, I find that, you know, people want to know things, people want to ask questions, but at the end of the day, they learn something, but they don't understand it, right? So this is me wearing the shirt, gifting non-natives, especially white folk, the ability to
be uncomfortable and get to experience that emotion, that range of feelings that come with it. So you're welcome, white people.
Oh, and thank you. I mean, I thought it was, I just thought it was fantastic. And like I said, I had gone through the experience because in looking at it and being like, okay, what is this, right? Native fashion now. And there was, I love the subversive elements that were in there. And I had seen a video of a guy, I think it was in New York City, it might've been an African-American gentleman. And he went around all day, you know, just went around all day putting, you know, his body, you know, on the line and just look at it, right? Look at the presentation that's here. That's what's going on. So
that response that's in the video, right? You know,
yes.
you see that response and it's jarring because you've got a black relative standing and making a statement for another group of peoples who there is a kindred feeling of just misrepresentation. And again, you know, like the term like romantification or fetishization of an entire group of peoples. You know, I know that I have peers in black communities that definitely have spoken the same things that I feel. And it's amazing that it's so parallel, right? To know that your entire identity is something that people, there's a saying like they want the culture, but not the struggle.
Right. There were certain pieces of it or outcroppings of it. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Well, one of the things I was wondering if you could you just kind of lend some insight as far as like conversations about representation and culture. And I know and I'm talking about First Nations, Indigenous peoples, representation and culture. And we started that when we were talking about the chapter house and art arriving in that space in general. I was wondering if you have ideas or way to place in this country the fetishization and sometimes infantilization, infantilizing of Native peoples of I've heard you comment in the past about how very few tribes, the Plains tribes in particular, I think you had said before 11 Plains tribes that wore headdress, right? So we're talking about American tropes, American symbols of Native peoples. What can be done about recognizing that display? And what can be done to help combat that display, which just perpetuates centuries-old views of Native peoples?
So this is one of my favorite things to talk about, honestly, is, and I'm going to do a comparison of these quote-unquote countries that, you know, arbitrary borders, Canada and the United States. So growing up as a First Nations person in Canada, First Nations people are celebrated, they are seen aesthetically, but they are hated. Like, I have not experienced such systemic racism and hatred as I have in the prairies of Canada. Even so much as my own family, my European family making comments about how Indians are drunk, stinky, whatever, and then looking at me and saying, but not like you, you made something of yourself. So that's how deeply ingrained it is in Canada. And in the United States, living here, I really realized that Native folks are treated like a thing of the past, again, romanticized and fetishized for, you know, they're things, but not for who they actually are, or even recognizing the fact that they're very much present here. Like, You know, I forget where I heard it, but I know there's like a story about a person that was in a secondhand store, and a little girl picked up a doll and was like, didn't said to their parent, they're like, do Indians really look like this? And I guess somebody was standing right there and said, no, they look like this because they were a native person.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, so those things of like, you know, kind of, and I don't even like the term Western culture anymore because I call a spade a spade. This incredibly racist, misogynistic, like just patriarchal garbage that we live in the United States is really at fault for everything that we are sitting in right now. As just people living on land. I'm not even just speaking about Native people, and this goes with Canada too, is that it's absolutely 100% the failings of these people that are in positions of colonial power, because power is such a not a construct that I think is real. There's no such thing as power. There's a thing as such as like there's authority, but there's no power. Power is something that was created to keep white men in a position to control. That's it, right? So I know so many people that are doing things to educate in grassroots forms to let people know there's documentaries, there's speakers, there's people that are writing books, there's so much free information. But when your colonial structure is not telling truth, that's where the damage really stems from. And so, you know, we could talk about there's a documentary that came out a long time ago now, like over 10 years. It's called Real Injun, which is REELINJUN, and it was directed by a fellow named Neil Diamond, who's First Nations from the north, and he depicted, you know, this like just kind of showed Hollywood's portrayal of the noble savage. And you know, I blame that as well. You know, people want to choose things that fit the narrative that fits them and makes them comfortable, and they don't take anything from a holistic approach. You know, like I think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to build back up. And I feel so sad saying this, and it almost makes me want to cry. Like there's so much work that needs to be done to not only build up Native people in our own eyes, but to build us back up in the eyes of the people who occupy our lands, because we can't undo what's been done, but we can build ourselves back up. And when we build ourselves back up, you know, maybe we'll finally be seen as human beings to other folks.
Well, yeah, and thank you, SA. And I think that's the part for me is like when I've when I've done my own research as, 40-year-old white man, and my ethical credo has to do on the basis of what you just said as far as treating people as humans, and to be dealing with social problems where that foundational element, we're still working on the foundational element of like see me, and I think that's deeply embedded in that problem of the presentation. I saw that a documentary, Real Injun, and I thought it was helpful for me. I saw it once, and I thought it was helpful for me to understand or like collate the images, the powerful images of Hollywood, in taking, horrific racist pieces of shit like John Wayne, and just this white male frontier hatred, like in film and in
It's
fact.
entitled, though. that entitlement that's been created as Americana, right? Because, like, you know, we're the only nation that really, like, and by nation, I roll my eyes when I talk sometimes, but, like, which no one can see right now. But the United States celebrates Columbus Day. No one else celebrates that. Like the idea of discovery, right? Because if you take away the idea of discovery, it just proves that there's no title or ownership to these lands, that everything was done so unethically and terribly. Like, it's kind of gross, for lack of a better term, you know, that this country is coasting by on an idea. Like, and by an idea, I mean, like, something that is a fantasy world. Like, this, like, the folklore of America is 100% fantasy. Like, I was back home in back in my homelands in what's known as Montana earlier this year, and I was reading this plaque along the way, and it was talking about this explorer, and I think his name was Jedediah Smith or something like that, and how
Jedediah Springfield.
Oh my God, is absolute cartoony. Yeah. But it said that, and this is the thing that got to me, because as a peer of mine says, you know, you can't discover lands that are already inhabited, right? This plaque legitimately said that this white man rediscovered and I was like I actually have it on my Instagram page, like a reaction photo where it's like it zooms in on the word rediscovered in my reaction face, like as you go across the slides, because I was just like, I felt like I actually, like, I don't subscribe to, like, the idea of IQ or intellect necessarily, where it's like you have to do all these things, but I felt like I was getting dumber.
I think that can happen. I think people, a lot of times with conversations, they think that can be neutral. Coming into contact with information is at least neutral, or you can be improved by it. But I think you might have experienced, I've experienced an extraction of intelligence through your through that type of encounter. Rediscovery, the power of verbs. Do you know the name of go ahead.
No, rainbow. Yeah.
One of the this is just a quick aside, and it's based on, you know, a little bit on the American, you know, history. Do you know George Washington's I think it was his Iroquois name that he proudly wore and was constantly referred to his entire life, referred to himself amongst Native peoples, and he was referred to as. Do you know what his name was?
I hope it was Walking Eagle, but what was it?
Destroyer of Villages.
That's hilarious. I'd go with Walking Eagle because he was so full of shit. But I think that the one thing I want to bring up is, like, and I know, like, this is a big thing for me, is what people want to be called or want to be referred to, because I'm so also tired. Like, I know that we're on the footsteps of, you know, Native American Heritage Month here in the U.S. And I don't like being called a Native American. I don't even really want to be called Indigenous. First Nations, I'm like kind of okay with, but I want to be called a Cree and Métis or Machif person, because that's what I am, right? I don't want to be lumped into some category, because each nation has its own languages, you know, practices, et cetera, and so forth. And the thing that always gets me with the Iroquois is they're actually, that's the French name, right? Their name is Haudenosaunee. But, you know, that's, you know, if somebody from that nation wants to be called Iroquois, great. But, like, also, I think we should be honoring their actual names.
Yeah, we have that same thing with the Nez Perce, right? I mean, well, and I appreciate you saying that, because I've encountered, you know, in even kind of framing questions and thinking about these issues, the question of language, you know. So, I mean, I think philosophy in art, right? So the podcast is about philosophy and art, but it's about language and language capturing, you know, reality, or an attempt to capture reality. And I've known, or I hate to say recently discovered or realized, how language, you can say certain things in languages and other things you can't say. So there's a natural, feels to me sometimes there's just a natural limitation on the language, or me referring to them as Iroquois, I would not know, you know what I mean? Like, it's just trying mm-hmm. to make the right reference point and, like, you know, honor the name yeah. fundamentally.
Well, and that's the other thing too that's funny is, like, a lot of the names that were given to tribes or different indigenous folks here, you know, like, I think about the Chippewa. I'm like, that's not really a thing. It's actually Ojibwe. It's, and I've heard in passing that it was because the settlers couldn't say Ojibwe, so they decided to call them Chippewa.
Like, well, even the, of course, like, you know, the first name, and a lot of folks have to, you know, the kind of typical example is, oh, that's too difficult for me to pronounce. Can I call yeah. you Manny? You know?
Yeah. Well, that's actually, you know, what's really funny, and I'm going to share this with you right now, Ken, is I do run, I do direct a program, and I actually am hosting interviews of folks as well. And it was funny because today I had to reach out to the guest and get the proper phonetic spelling of that, like, or the phonetic spelling of their name, because I didn't want to mispronounce it. And it was their English name. I felt so silly. I was like, I don't know how to say your name. And usually it's the other way around, right? Where it's like, you know, the ethnic name, right?
Right. I wanted to, I guess part of this is, I'll get to the question, but part of my journey on this podcast, and I try to cover a lot of topics, but I went down a path of learning, of deep learning, that I'm still on. And it has to do with the intersection or the connection amongst the genocide and missing and murdered indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit in Canada and the United States, a connection to the environmental activism, the pipeline protests, the deep, deep struggle with many peoples that are still in, connected to the labor that constructs, you know, disrupts, destroys the environment, but also the physical man labor, the man camps around these areas, in this incredible intersection of violence against the earth, horrific violence, generational violence against the women, that is still going on. I know you've done some work in these areas, and it's a really difficult area. The podcast, you know, I've done 4 episodes exploring this, both from my understanding and to try to bring awareness around this issue. I want to ask you a kind of a tough question, but when I talked about the different pieces that are going into this genocide, this environmental destruction, and the man camps, how do you get at that problem, that those threads, all those pieces melded in there? What do we do about that?
This is a difficult one to answer, because I don't consider myself an expert or a speaker on
as
issues.
An understood, but as an activist, because you do things, you like what's to be done?
Well, you know, my initial response is, I think, you know, as we want to be considered a progressive culture of people, I think that, you know, it's time to progress past raping the land for its what colonizers refer to as natural resources.
Right.
And especially surrounding issue with MMIWG2S or MMIP, which is, you know, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples. We're from the land. We are the land. And when the land suffers, we suffer. And so, you know, I think that I made a statement one time for my TMX pipeline rally, and it was, you know, that they brought with them disease. Disease of the body, disease of the mind, disease of ownership and greed. And I think that there is a huge aspect of that there that basically means that we need to teach, people need to learn that people and land are not commodities, and that ownership is just a facade to hold that colonial structure of power. And I'm so in awe of my peers who continue to work on the front lines of these issues in MMIW that set up counter camps. You know, I've seen what's happened in my homelands and in Alberta with the oil industry, and I've seen terrible things happen there to Native peoples. You know, there's even a story. I was in Duluth, Minnesota last year, and a peer told me a story about how they were raising money to basically scrape the lake to bring the women that had been thrown off of boats home, the women that are taken and abused because of industry and cast away like garbage. And that really got to me because they treat the environment and they treat the people the same, like it's disposable or always going to be there. And that's the hard thing, and that's the thing we need to teach people, is that we need to honor the land and we need to honor the people that are of the land. But yeah, because they aren't from these lands, Ken, they don't care because they don't feel anything, but we feel it.
Yeah, there's no connection to.
Yeah. It's easy to abuse something that you have no connection to, but these are the same people that will spout off patriotism. And how can you be patriotic to something when you don't even take care of it?
Yeah. Thank you. And we're talking with S.A. Lawrence Welch. And S.A., I have we got some bigger conceptual questions that
all right.
I'm assuming, like the what is art mic drop, you probably knock out of the park. Love talking to you. What or who made you who you are?
I am who I am because of Kishi Manitou, who is the creator. I am who I am because of Ne Papa, who is my father. I am who I am because I have cultivated experiences and have been put in situations where I had no consent and I was forced to learn things that have helped me grow and learn and experience every range of emotion to understand who I am from a foundational level, I guess, to be the best possible version of myself so I can potentially, and I don't want to say inspire, but maybe inspire people who have been in situations where they have felt like they don't have value to know that they do and that there's validity to life, you know? And so I think that the things that have made me is the range of the path that I've been on, you know? I can reflect on the negative things, but I reflect on a lot of the positive things because I get to still be here. So.
Yeah, yeah. Why is there something rather than nothing?
I could make a joke here, but
jokes are good. Philosophy is just jokes. That's all it is jokes.
Like just a bunch of horny molecules, you know? No, honestly, there's something because there has to be, because existence is, you know, like, I don't know how to articulate this without sounding like verbal diarrhea, but it's definitely, there's something because there has to be, because if there isn't, then we wouldn't, right? So that's I don't know how to say that without sounding like the cheese slipped off the cracker.
I like that.
I like that meme of that guy that's like, you know, the one where he's like aliens and his hair is sticking straight up. That's me right now.
No, thank you so much. Listeners, as you know, I've learned a lot from Essay. And you know, for you, I just wanted to let you know or give you the opportunity to extend to listeners the work that you do, the art, the advocacy, the groups that you work with. I think it's important to whatever your comfort level is to connect people to these issues. To whatever level of your comfort, could you let listeners know how to connect with your work in you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that opportunity. I'm so proud that at the end of September on Orange Shirt Day, which is the 30th, I was able to announce the launch of my project, the Kikichi Haiwi Win Project, which translates to healing through words, basically. And it's a project that surrounds the community healing of those who have suffered the trauma of residential and boarding schools, the SCOOP, foster care and forced assimilation tactics by colonial governments. Presently right now, I'm focusing on so-called Canada, the US, and so-called Australia. But I hope to branch out more as the project grows. And basically, it's a way to learn history, but learn what people are doing to heal again and heal their communities and stop the trials of intergenerational trauma that affect every single Native person that I know. I also, and you can get a hold of me through that by visiting the org that I work with, which is Seeding Sovereignty. So it's seedingsovereignty.org/TKP. I also work with the Chapter House, which you can find at thechapterhouse.org, which is a art organization based out of LA and spans across the Navajo Nation. I also am the co-creator of the Oki Language Project, which you can find at OKILanguageProject.com. It's a project to tell stories about Indigenous language greetings and how our words are so much more than just words, but they can tell stories. What else do I do? I work with Red Hawk Native American Arts Council, which you can find at redhawkcouncil.org. And it is a it's been around for about 27 years. It's based out of New York City, and it is just a really great org that brings together arts and culture in-person events and through online education. Unfortunately, this year, we weren't able to do any in-person events due to the ongoing COVID crisis, but there's a lot of, available from them online. Gosh, I don't know what else I do. I do a lot of things, but I do all the things that I do out of a labor of love, because I so truly believe in bringing people together through community work to heal. And I'm just so grateful that I've had the experiences I've had and the ability to work with so many incredible Native folks to learn from and to just cultivate, again, the best possible version of myself so I can continue to help everyone.
Well, and thank you for your work, and thank you for your time. It's been important for me to meet you and to learn from you. And another thing, too, is on the podcast over time, I tried to, you know, we talk about art and there's conceptual and we talk about a lot of issues, but there's also pieces where I try to build in kind of like performances, whether it be musical and otherwise. And I would openly invite, you and other artists or presenters space on the show for some of the art if you find it appropriate and useful. I just wanted to make that open invitation to you to present, to have presentation of, you know, art performance on the show. I wanted to deeply, again, thank you for your time and really just that my opportunity for me, as I've said on the podcast, I'd like to extend this out to folks, but a lot of the podcast tends to be looking into things and learning for me, and you've certainly helped with that process. So deep thanks, SA. I really appreciate you appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, Kananaskomatin, that's that means thank you, and I'm grateful. And in Michif, you know, Marseille, I really, that's, you know, thank you. I'm glad to have shared virtual time and space with you today.
Yeah, thanks. And I know we're both big comic book fans, so we could talk about that in the future, or we can delve into those at another time.
Well, we could definitely bring up the new release from Marvel with the Indigenous superheroes. So we'll have a little chat about that sooner than later.
on that point, is that out?
Is it out yet? I don't know. I haven't checked.
I don't know either. We'll have to check. I'll add it to the.
And I'll show you my collection of the Native American action figures I have.
All right, I'm really digging. I'm really digging what's going on here. Thank you again so much, SA, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, hi, thank you.
Hi.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing.